From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the lawyer who won Roe v. Wade. We talk with Sarah Weddington. She was 25 when she went before the Supreme Court to argue for a woman's right to abortion. In her new memoir, she reveals that she had an abortion before taking on the case. Also, Jim Lehrer's recurring nightmare. We talk with the co-anchor of the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. And Woody Allen's new film opens this weekend. People will be lining up to look for parallels between his art and his life. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Husbands and Wives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Calm returned to European currency markets after yesterday's shakeup of currency values. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
Currency traders took their profits from yesterday's transactions as the governments hardest hit by yesterday's activities tried to limit the damage to their economies. In Britain, the government rescinded the interest rate increase it had instituted in the hope of saving the pound. In Italy, the government suspended trading of the lira until after Sunday's French vote on the Maastricht Treaty on closer European Union. Despite the rough ride given the lira this week, tonight the Italian Senate overwhelmingly voted to approve the Maastricht Treaty. Italian Foreign Minister Emilio Colombo said the current foreign exchange crisis was caused by a lack of Maastricht. Colombo also called for an emergency European Community summit to discuss the currency crisis. He was supported in his call by French President François Mitterrand. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
The former chief of staff at the House Post Office pleaded guilty today in a criminal investigation that could lead to members of Congress and their campaigns. Joanna O'Rourke is the highest-ranking official to be indicted in the post office scandal. She pleaded guilty to two misdemeanors, embezzlement of government property and misuse of government funds by a public officer. Prosecutors said that O'Rourke conspired to cash large campaign and personal checks. The prosecutor's statement made clear for the first time in public that the investigation is looking at possible illegalities in cashing campaign checks at the House Post Office. President Bush campaigned in Oklahoma today and delivered a strong attack against his opponent, Bill Clinton, characterizing his plans for the nation as a resurrected version of social engineering. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
From Santa Monica to Cambridge, my opponent and his advisors are cranking up their models, ready to test them on you, President Bush told a rural audience in Enid, Oklahoma today. The president traced Clinton's economic, health, and education proposals to the social engineering ideas of the turn of the century. The lengthy speech was aimed at defining the differing approaches of the two candidates to the economy, but the bulk of it characterized Clinton's proposals as large-scale government ownership. He wants to raise taxes, and there's a motive to his madness, Mr. Bush said. He needs money to pay for his social engineering, a phrase the president used four times in his 30-minute speech. Mr. Bush's attempt to link Clinton's policies with centralized government and the command and control economy of the former Soviet Union was well received in Oklahoma. A state political consultant say Mr. Bush should have locked up weeks ago. I'm Elizabeth Arnold reporting.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 4 points to close at 3,315.7. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading of about 188 million shares. This is NPR News. Iran-Contra prosecutor Lawrence Walsh said today that he's ended his 5.5-year investigation of the Iran-Contra scandal. Walsh said that he doesn't expect any more indictments of top officials from the Reagan administration in the absence of some new development. The special prosecutor's office will go ahead with its cases against former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and former CIA official Duane Claridge. Walsh said today that he also intends to retry former CIA official Claire George, whose first trial ended last month with a hung jury. Supporters of the Family and Medical Leave Act aren't standing by waiting for the president to veto the bill. They're introducing a new package of legislation that combines the family leave provisions with other family-oriented measures that haven't been passed yet this session. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
The new Family Investment Act would provide extra funding for Head Start and the Women, Infants, and Children's Program, along with projects designed to combat drugs, gangs, and child abuse. Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut says all of these problems are linked and affect a child's future.
It's not a menu. You cannot pick and choose from them. The WIC child is also the Head Start child, which is also the child facing violence, which is also the child that is probably not getting as much parental involvement in their education. It's also the child who maybe have both parents working or being raised in a single-parent household, and where a crisis occurs, that family needs support to be able to hold together.
Democratic and Republican sponsors of the measure argue they're not playing politics. They believe that with the attention the family issues are getting in the presidential campaign, they can pass the bill this late in the session. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Officials of the OPEC oil cartel agreed today to freeze their production of crude oil near current levels for the rest of the year. The agreement is designed to drive oil prices up to the target rate of $21 a barrel. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the lawyer who won Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that legalized abortion in 1973. Sarah Weddington was only 25 years old when she went before the Supreme Court. The right she won is in jeopardy, so abortion has remained her issue, although she says she wishes she could move on to something else. She spent much of the past decade traveling around the country, speaking on college campuses about abortion rights. Weddington has served in the Texas State Legislature and served in President Carter's administration. She's written a new memoir called A Question of Choice. In this book, she reveals that she had an abortion while she was in law school. I asked her why she kept her abortion a secret until now.
I'm a very private person. I'm an introvert. I don't like talking about personal things. And I always thought that I had really worked on this case for all women and to be sure that they were spared what I and millions of others knew. It was also that I thought my story was not as dramatic as many others because my boyfriend, then soon-to-be husband, went with me. We did end up with a good doctor. I didn't have any medical problems. And millions of women had terrible experiences. The reason I finally did go public now is because I think we can't save it in a court of law, and the usual legal arguments aren't working. And so it has to be an argument in the ballot box, in the court of public opinion. And I think there are many of us who've never told our stories. And what is so important is that abortion has been an issue. It is something a lot of women in this country have known, both illegal and legal. And maybe the way to save it is for us just to talk to our neighbors and our friends and people who like and respect us and share our personal experiences.
Did you think that it would hurt you if people found out that you had an abortion?
Well, I think if you look back at the time I went and had an abortion, which was my last year in law school, it was a time when I was very embarrassed to have been pregnant. That was something you just didn't do. Especially not before marriage. I was disappointed with myself. It was one of those things I wanted to always be a secret. I don't feel so strongly about it today, but I do feel that part of the reason we fought the issue was for privacy. So people made decisions in private. They could carry them out in private. It wasn't something I thought women should always have to talk about. Unfortunately, we're just in a danger zone. The other thing was I didn't want every time I started talking about the legal aspects to get it totally off on that, and I mm-hmm. thought the opponents would try to do that. And so the only reason I told it now is because I think we have to save it in the November election. And if we can save it then, it will have been well worth my telling my story, and I think for others to tell theirs.
I'd like to hear a little bit more of your story. So you were in your last year of law school when you were pregnant. You were in a relationship with someone who you later married.
That's right, and who helped with the case.
And why didn't you want to have a baby at that point?
Well, I was working two jobs already, trying to put myself through law school. My daddy's a preacher. He was making $9,000 a year at the time. They had two younger children who were both in college. They were supporting them. I was supporting myself. Ron had come back from military service, and he was finishing undergraduate. He was just getting ready to start law school, and so we were looking at supporting ourselves for three more years. It was not a time that we felt we could really afford, support, have the time for. a child at that point. And Ron had never really particularly wanted children anyway, and I had known that from the beginning of the relationship. And there were a variety of reasons, as I think there always are.
Did you have girlfriends, or did you know other young women who had become pregnant when they didn't want to, had the baby, and had their lives changed in ways that they didn't want?
Well, I certainly knew some women in high school, a couple in college. In fact, there had been one woman who had become pregnant our first year in law school, one of five, and who had dropped out of law school. And so I had known those women who had gone through the pregnancy and seen how they usually had to drop out and how the future they thought was theirs was very much diminished as a consequence. I frankly don't think I knew anyone who had had an abortion. I mean, I did, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't know that they had. It wasn't anything anyone had ever talked to me about. And so for me to go to Mexico, I didn't speak Spanish. I was absolutely petrified about it. But I was also determined that I was going to finish law school. I was going to help Ron finish law school. And we were going to establish a wider world for ourselves than women had traditionally known. And I saw pregnancy at that point as something that had tethered women to a very limited future.
Yeah, you had your abortion in Mexico. The law in Texas at the time, I believe, said that abortion would only be allowed if it would save the life of the woman.
That's right. It was the only reason. So rape, incest, those were not justifications. Anything having to do with health or economics or nothing except to save the life of the woman.
How come you didn't have an illegal abortion in Texas? You probably could have found a doctor willing to do it.
You know, the only thing is that Ron was the one who went to find a name of some place to go, and the name he came up with was the doctor in Mexico, and a couple of people that he knew said that they knew people who had been there and had had good experiences and that it was safe. And so, frankly, it's probably just the luck of the draw in terms of the name we happened to come up with. Now I know there were people doing abortions illegally in Texas, but we didn't find those names, and there was no central place to find a name.
As a law student at the time, was it a crisis for you to do something that you knew was breaking the law?
No, I can't. I mean, it was really scary. It was I was petrified to find myself in that situation, but I was so determined that I would have done anything to escape the law in Texas.
So you had a good physical recovery?
No problems. I was back in class on Monday.
Emotional impact on your life?
You know, I know it would make a better story if I could say it had a major impact, but it didn't. I think that most women really go through a process of thinking through the options. They choose the one that they feel is best for them. I am very glad I went through that. I think having finished law school and the options that were open to me as a woman with that education, to be able to do the things I have to help save millions of other women, that is such a positive feedback in my life that it's kind of like being married. I'm glad I was married. I'm not sorry I was divorced. Obviously, you think about it some, but I would do it over again.
In your memoir, you say that you didn't think you were the right person to argue abortion rights before the Supreme Court. Why?
Well, it was my first contested case.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, I look back now, and of course, when I got out of law school, I couldn't get a job. It was 1967. The firms in Texas weren't ready to hire women. And so I ended up doing research for a professor. And when these women said, you know, would you help us look into this, I had some extra time. Ron was in law school. I was working at the law school, so I had the library right there. But essentially, I said, well, you know, I think you really need somebody older, somebody with more experience. And they said, well, first, you're the only person we've come up with who's willing to do it for free. And we think it ought to be a woman attorney. You're the only woman attorney we know. And then UT Law School really does train people in how to think about law, not so much where the courthouse is, but how to think about it. And so it wasn't that I was the best choice. It was just I was willing to do it and cared a great deal about the issue.
How did you find Norma McCorvey, the woman who became known as Jane Roe in the case, the plaintiff?
Well, because I had not done any other contested cases, I had done uncontested divorces, a few wills for people with no money, and an adoption for a relative, I knew I needed some help. And of the five women who started in my class in 1965, One of them was Linda Coffey, and she had graduated and gone to work for a federal judge. So I thought she would know something about federal procedures, and she would have seen more trials. So I called Linda. She said she would be co-counsel, and originally we thought the women in Austin would be plaintiffs, but none of them were pregnant, or those who were able to make a responsible decision early to move on, to have the abortion, have the child. They didn't turn out to be the plaintiff. And so first we found a married couple in Dallas that she had a neurochemical disorder. The doctor said, don't get pregnant, don't take the pill, and they were saying, as a married couple, this puts us in a terrible quandary. So first we were doing the case with them, and then Jane Roe went to a male attorney in Dallas, said, I'm pregnant, I don't want to be, I want an abortion. He said, I do adoption work, but if you think you really are adamant about an abortion, I know two young women who are looking for a case for a plaintiff, and why don't you go see them? And by that point, we were having the legal papers pretty much ready to go, had a few things we still had to look up. And she said, well, what would it entail for me? And we said, well, no money. We're raising that. We're donating time. Not much time at all. She did end up signing a one-page legal affidavit, but never went to any of the court proceedings, no depositions, no interrogatories. And we said, you can be anonymous. So she was willing to do it in part because her personal involvement was so minimal. And that was because she was, in essence, a figurehead for all of those women. It was a class action on behalf of all women who were or might become pregnant and want to consider all options.
Did you think that she was the right figurehead, or didn't it matter?
Well, I didn't know it was a U.S. Supreme Court case. I would have, if I knew then what I know now, I would have been much more careful in picking a plaintiff. But at the time, I thought some of the things about her were good. For example, she had dropped out of school, never finished high school. She had run away from home very early. She had already had a child. Her mother took it away from her on the basis she was unfit to raise a child. And so I thought there were a lot of sympathetic factors in her fact situation. But we always thought of it as a case that was for lots of women, not just for one. And I frankly thought some other case would get to the Supreme Court, the New York case, the New Jersey case, the Illinois case. There were cases just springing up all over the country. And so I assumed that we were doing the Texas case, and we were adding to the momentum of legal ferment, of legal work that would someday lead to some case getting to the Supreme Court. It never occurred to me when we filed Roe versus Wade that this would become the Supreme Court vehicle.
In your argument, you never mentioned how Jane Roe got pregnant, and you later learned that she had lied in some press interviews and said that she was raped when she actually wasn't. Do you know why she lied?
No, and I've never asked her that. When she first came to us, she said, would it help if I'd been raped? And we said no. There was no exception in the Texas law for rape. It made no difference. And we did ask her if there were any police reports, any interviews, anything that we could prove that she had been raped, and she said no. So to us, the issue was not, how did you get pregnant? We thought that was a totally irrelevant legal issue.
And that's why you left it out.
And that's why we left it out, because we also didn't want to focus on an issue of rape. We didn't want to say anything to the court we couldn't prove. And it was actually 6 months after the decision in the June 1973 Good Housekeeping. And when I got it, I wasn't there when the writer interviewed her because she lived in Dallas. I was in Austin. And so I got that article when it came out, and I started reading all this stuff about the rape, and I was just incredulous about it. But I didn't know if it was true or not. And for many years, I didn't know if it was true or not. Her story got bigger as the years went by. And finally, in 1989, Carl Rowan interviewed her just a couple of days before the Bork nomination. We were working so hard on trying to beat that. And he said to her, what about the rape? And she said, I lied.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Sarah Weddington. She's the lawyer who argued and won the Roe v. Wade decision in the Supreme Court, the decision that legalized abortion. She's written a new book called A Question of Choice. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is lawyer Sarah Weddington, who won the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in 1973. You didn't think that your test case would be the case that made it to the Supreme Court. How did your case get to be the one?
Well, it was a period when all the lawyers in these cases were sharing information. Harriet Pilpel, who was the New York lawyer for Planned Parenthood, was marvelously helpful. And so it was kind of like a synthesis of good legal thought and talent around the country coming to a consensus about how to present the case. In this case, of course, I picked up on the Griswold versus Connecticut case from 1965, which Harriet had been very involved in. That was the case where Connecticut had made the use of birth control illegal. If you were married or single, made no difference. Using birth control was a criminal offense. And a woman named Estelle Griswold, who was the director of the Planned Parenthood in New Haven, gave a contraceptive device to a married couple, was arrested, convicted, fined. She appealed it to the Supreme Court, and the court had said there is a right of privacy to decide whether to bear or begat a child. It was the best specific language we had from a Supreme Court case. And so we took that line of privacy as being our basic focus, and then also how fundamental pregnancy is for women, because the Supreme Court will usually not overturn a state statute unless it's really very personal, very basic. And so we were saying we think nothing affects a woman's life more than the number and spacing of her children. And then the state of Texas was saying, oh, but we have a right to pass these laws to protect potential unborn life. And we were saying, well, you haven't treated the fetus like a person in any other situation. You can't pick out this one situation that interferes with liberty for women and say, suddenly, here, we're going to do it.
Explain a little bit more. Why did your case become the case that was argued before the Supreme Court of all the test cases that were out there?
Terry, I think it was a couple of things. One, there had been a prior case where they did not appeal. There was one where the wrong party appealed. And the thought was that the Supreme Court was looking for a case, actually two cases, that would be representative of all the different laws around the country, and therefore by deciding those cases, the court could essentially decide the law pertaining to states all over, and therefore they wouldn't have to deal with other cases. So they chose the Texas case, which was the very restrictive law, as we've already said. And then they also took a case from Georgia, which was a state that had a law that about 13 or so states had, which we then called the liberalized law. It was a law that said abortion is lawful for rape, incest, fetal deformity to save the life or health of the woman, but she has to go through a lot of hoops in order to get there. But with the Texas and the Georgia case combined, the court had before it representative cases of most of the states and their laws at that time.
I want to get back to your argument. You had expanded the part of your brief on why the fetus is not a person, and you argued that legal rights begin at birth. Why did you decide to expand the part of the brief on why a fetus is not a person?
Well, we thought that that was crucial because the state was arguing that its right to regulate was to protect the fetus. And yet, the more we tried to research the legal status of the fetus, it clearly didn't support what the state was saying. For example, the Constitution says all persons born or naturalized are citizens. It is under law. We've always taken a census, but we don't count pregnant women twice. Pregnant women who leave the country don't get two passports. You get a tax deduction for the year a child is born. In Texas, murder was the killing of one who has been born. Rights of inheritance were contingent on being born alive. And so while I was personally uneasy and thought the court would be with the later stage of pregnancy, when I tried to look for legal hooks, birth had always been the determining moment. And so that's why I ended up arguing to the court that based on our legal history, birth was the moment at which legal rights attached. The court instead said there's a trimester approach. It was dictum. It was advisory. It wasn't part of the opinion. But the court clearly said to the states, now, if you want to prohibit abortion in third trimester, you can, except to save the life or perhaps extreme health of the woman.
You know, this trimester part of the decision really surprised you. You say that it's very rare for the judges to include a concept that wasn't argued in the case.
Exactly. You see, I had never heard of the trimester approach. It was not in the briefs. It was not in the oral arguments. And the first time I ever saw it was when I read the opinion. Now, some books written have said that Blackman was spending time at the Mayo Clinic before the opinion was written, and I know that part's true. But some books have said that Blackman was talking to some doctors and they made that a suggestion. Other people who have heard Blackman talk about the issue have said that it was a concept original to him and one that he put into the opinion. I don't know which the true story is, but I think the court's idea was that there was going to be still a lot of state legislation, that if they gave the state some guidance about what they thought was within constitutional boundaries and what wasn't, it would just save time, and the court wouldn't have to be dealing with the issue time and time again. Of course, that feeling, if I'm accurate about the court's perception, turned out to be very inaccurate.
Did you think that the anti-abortion activists would mobilize right away and keep it up for as long as they have?
No, I really underestimated that. I knew that they would be very upset by the decision. I knew they would try to undermine it. But what I did not foresee was the changes in the makeup of the Supreme Court. So through the years of the 70s, the battles we fought, the skirmishes, were over a constitutional amendment that those opposed to abortion were trying to make abortion illegal, unavailable. We fought skirmishes about whether there would be funding for women who were otherwise eligible for federal medical services. We fought a number of what I call sort of side battles. But then in 1980, that seesaw started to turn, to move. Before Roe v.ersus Wade, before the decision, clearly those who were pro-choice were on the ascendancy and I think peaked with Roe v.ersus Wade. And then the opposition began to mobilize and they began to move on that seesaw. And I think the peak came in 1989 with the Webster decision. But it started moving when Reagan was elected and started appointing judges who had a far different concept of Roe v.ersus Wade and privacy. So that the Webster case in 1989 was the top of the momentum for those who were anti-choice, because at that point, those people who were pro-choice suddenly said, you know, I don't think we can take this for granted much longer. Look at what's happening with the court. And so people began to join pro-choice organizations, to pay more attention to the issue. That was accelerated with the Casey, Pennsylvania case this last few months.
And just to clarify, the Webster decision to which you referred is the 1989 decision by the Supreme Court that ruled a state could prohibit the use of public buildings and public employees from performing abortions.
That's right.
Do you ever wish that you were back in court arguing one of the abortion test cases?
No, because I think there are other people who are best able to do those now, who have the full-time resources and the backup staffs to really do it well. And frankly, I think your chances of winning today are much less than they were before. I was very fortunate to go before the Supreme Court when there were the judges on the court that you had a good chance of winning. Now I think the legal action is often like a rear guard action. It's an action to keep further erosion from happening, but it's not where we're making big progress.
Sarah Weddington is the lawyer who won Roe v.ersus Wade, the case that guaranteed a woman's right to abortion. She's written a new memoir called A Question of Choice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As the co-anchor of the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, Jim Lehrer works hard to keep his personal opinions and personal life out of his broadcasts. Coming up, Lehrer tells us some of the stories you're not likely to hear on his own show. Woody Allen's personal life has become a public scandal, and as awful as that's been for Allen, it will probably be good for ticket sales to his new film Husbands and Wives, which opens this weekend. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The head of the International Monetary Fund says that the European currency crisis, the worst in 20 years, highlights the urgent need for nations to get their bloated budget deficits under control. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
IMF Director Michel Camdesou singled out Italy and Germany as two countries which have yet to deal with their budget deficits. In particular, the cost of German unification has forced that country to maintain high interest rates in order to keep inflation in check. And it's those steep interest rates that many analysts believe triggered the crisis, as investors funneled their money out of other European currencies and into the more attractive German mark. Today, Italy joined Britain in suspending its participation in the system that ties together European currencies. Despite his concern, Camdesou said he did not believe the currency crisis poses a serious threat to plans for European unity, but he was quick to add that the lessons of the crisis should not be lost. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
In advance of a weekend vote in France, Italy's Senate has approved a treaty on closer European unity. The vote was 176-16 with one abstention. Meanwhile, Italy's foreign minister has announced that EC foreign ministers will meet this Monday in New York City, where they will be attending the UN General Assembly to discuss this weekend's vote in France. The government of Italy is a strong supporter of the proposed treaty, and a no vote by France would most likely mean an end to the agreement as it stands now and its purpose of economic and political unity for Europe. In Washington, the independent counsel looking into the Iran-Contra scandal announced today that he's ending his investigation. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh officially notified the appeals court that appoints independent counsels that, quote, "we do not expect to present any further matters to the grand jury in the absence of some new development before we close our offices." That's good news for some top officials in the Reagan administration, including former Attorney General Ed Meese and former Secretary of State George Shultz, as they were among those being investigated. Lawrence Walsh began his probe 5.5 years ago and has so far racked up 10 successful prosecutions, although the convictions against former Reagan aides Oliver North and John Poindexter were overturned. Walsh's office still has 3 trials pending, including one against Mr. Reagan's defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, on charges he lied to Congress. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
The nation's trade deficit climbed to its highest point in 1.5 years in July. The Commerce Department says the deficit grew by more than $1 billion in July as aircraft exports dropped. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points to close at 3,315.70. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin, under some pressure from the International Monetary Fund, has signed an order increasing oil prices in his country. Prices will just about double under the new plan. Both the IMF and Western governments have been pushing Russia to free energy prices, now subsidized by the Russian government. Yeltsin has resisted up to now, arguing that higher energy prices will touch off more inflation and might lead to social unrest. At Middle Eastern peace talks currently underway in Washington, Israeli and Syrian diplomats, who just yesterday indicated hope for a joint agreement on general principles, were considerably more glum today. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
As they left the State Department in Washington, the chief Syrian and Israeli negotiators both said there had been no progress today. No progress whatsoever, grumbled Muwafiq al-Alaf of Syria. He said the Israeli delegation seems to have no authority to discuss a return of the Golan Heights, a key Syrian demand. All they have authority to talk about, Alaf said, are the Israeli demands. Israel wants a full peace treaty from Syria. Alaf warned that Syria would not continue to discuss issues that are only one side of the peace process. He called on the U.S. to intervene in what threatens to become a deadlock. But Itamar Rabinovich, the chief Israeli delegate, said, "I don't think the United States needs to intervene." He argued that ups and downs are a normal part of negotiations, and we have to accept it as is. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On the eve of peace talks to try and end the fighting in Bosnia, heavy fighting occurred in the western part of the capital. One UN official said this was an apparent effort to stake out claims in advance of the talks. In the meantime, the government has turned down a Serbian proposal to start dividing the land into ethnic zones. As for the current fighting, one UN peacekeeper called it a war of attrition, with neither side having a chance to win. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jim Lehrer doesn't reveal much about himself on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, but in his so-called free time, he's been writing memoirs and novels. He has a new memoir called A Bus of My Own. It covers his career in public television and at a Dallas newspaper. And he writes about buses. He loves them. He collects bus memorabilia. His brother says if you cut him, you'd find diesel fuel instead of blood. Buses used to be the family business. In 1946, Lehrer's father started a small intercity bus line in Kansas with a total of 3 buses. The business went bankrupt in a year. Lehrer says the failure always stuck with his father, and Jim Lehrer thinks that might explain his own recurring nightmare of being fired. He dreams about being fired, even though he and Robert McNeil are now the heads of their own production company.
Yeah, the gods of the dreams haven't figured that out. I mean, I want to yell in back and say, "Hey, McNeil can't fire me." You know, I mean, we're partners. But in the dream, it's never clear how the word came to me. The dream begins where I'm sitting at an upright typewriter on the obit desk of the Dallas Morning News, and I'm old like I am right now. And all these young kids are standing around watching me. Oh, Lehrer, McNeil Lehrer, poor guy got fired, but he's back here and he can still write obits. It's a terrible dream, I'll tell you.
When was the last time you had it?
Oh, I have it a couple times a year. I can't remember the lot, but it's been within the last several months. It's usually, you know, there's no connection there's no connection between anything that even resembles anything firing. I mean, it's not that. I guess it just happens when I get down or something like that about things generally.
Right. You and McNeil have both been writing novels and memoirs in the past few years. How are we to interpret that? Where have you found the time to do it? What did you take the time from?
Well, I found that, and I think he has too, that there are certain things in life you want to do very badly, and if you want to do something badly enough, you can find time to do them. But In order to do that, you've got to quit doing the things you don't want to do.
So what'd you give up?
Well, I gave up making speeches. I gave up...
You mean on the road?
On the road.
Uh-huh.
I gave up going to lunch.
Every day, or you mean special
just
lunches?
Just about. I never go to lunch. Mm-hmm. I won't say never. In 9 years, I've gone out on a work day to lunch maybe 5 times. And I take a nap every afternoon, which gives me more energy. Kind of breaks my day into 2 days. And so in the end of the day, when I go home after having done the news hour, I'm not that exhausted. I still have energy left, both psychic and physical. And fortunately, in my case, my wife Kate is also a writer. She understands the needs, and as I understand hers, and so it all works. And the other thing too, you got to remember, Terry, is that Robin and I now have each in our own way been in daily journalism for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, daily journalism, whatever else it is the greatest concentrator. Greatest training ground for concentration there is. You go from one subject very intensely to another subject very intensely.
And it doesn't end.
And it never ends. Exactly right. And you can't spend a lot of time, you can't waste a lot of time worrying if the wind is right, how do you feel? You know, I have said I could write underwater at 5 in the morning, hungover, hanging by my thumbs. And McNeil is exactly the same way. He grew up in a wire service, the Reuters News Service. I grew up on an afternoon newspaper. And they don't hold deadlines for you. And in Daily Journal, they don't say, hey, we're not quite ready. Let's hold the newspaper. Hey, we're not quite ready to go on the air. Let's hold the broadcast. And it's part of us. And so it helps us when it comes time now we want to write fiction. You know, we just go from one to the other. Boom, there's no big deal about it.
You know the old cliche that no one on their deathbed ever said, I wish I'd spent more time in the office? That's always interpreted to mean that all you really think about when you think about the end of your life is relationships. And somehow I don't really think that's true. I think people really look back on their life and say, I wish I had done this, or I wish I'd had a chance to develop this talent or to write that book or whatever. You had a heart attack a few years ago. You were really afraid for your life. You had bypass surgery. When you looked back on your life, were there things you wanted to do? You know, not spending more time in the office, but things you wanted to do that you decided to make time for, like maybe writing books.
Exactly. Exactly right, Terry. You put your finger on it. That's exactly what happened to me. It isn't this thing of, looking back on my life. I looked ahead, and how much time I had left, whether it was 5 days, 5 months, 5 years, 25 years, I wanted to do these things. And in order to do them, I had to make some adjustments in my life, and that meant getting rid of the other things that I was doing and just to accommodate them. And and I've done it, and I'm very fortunate to be able to have done them.
You tell a pretty frightening story in your book how when you were getting wheeled into the operating room for your bypass surgery, the anesthesia hadn't taken full effect when the surgery was beginning, and yet you didn't have enough strength to, like, talk or scream or you know, intervene in any way. What a nightmare.
It was a nightmare. And as I say in the book, I had it, you know, for a long time afterward. Fortunately, that's not one night. I still have the firing nightmare about writing obits in the Dallas News, but I don't have that one anymore. But that was a petrifying experience, and I never went back and tried to figure out what it was because I didn't want to know. You know, everything turned out all right. By then, it didn't matter. But I saw those lights and everything, and I heard these people talking, and I thought, and they're about ready to start operating on me, and I wanted to say, hey, wait a minute. Hey, don't do that. Wait a minute. I'm not out yet. And I couldn't talk. So, but anyhow, it all turned out all right.
Is it possible that was a dream?
Oh, Terry, I hadn't thought about that. You mean that it really didn't happen?
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought of you. May be right. I might have been way out.
I think one of the reasons why I asked that is a recurring dream I've had all my life is that, you know, I'm kidnapped or, you know, someone's attacking me or whatever, and I can't scream. I can't move and I can't scream. And it just sounds so similar to what you experienced.
You may be absolutely right. I hadn't even considered that. It was so real to me that I just assumed that it happened. But obviously, I had been, I'd been drugged in some way. I mean, I had the anesthetic in me. I mean, it could very easily be only a dream.
Jim Lehrer is my guest. He's written a new memoir called A Bus of My Own. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jim Lehrer, co-anchor of the McNeil Lehrer News Hour. I want to get back to your early days in journalism when you started out in Dallas. First, I guess, writing obits like your nightmare.
Right.
And then eventually getting to be the city editor. You say that you started your career in journalism because Hemingway used to say, if you want to write, start by writing for newspapers. Start with journalism, but only do it a couple of years. How seriously did you take that? Did you really think of that as just like the preliminary, the first step onto the career as the great American novelist?
Oh, sure. I did. I really did. I thought, though, that I might be able to do both. I wasn't sure. But, yes, it was with me all the time from the very beginning of my desire to be a newspaper man. The desire to be a writer of fiction was there, too.
Now, you say when you were writing on this paper in Dallas, I guess it was when you were the city editor, that you realized what all newsrooms need or a few firings. Firing people for sloppiness, firing people for not caring. It's really hard to fire someone. How often have you really followed through on that in your career?
I have fired a few people for that kind of thing, not very many. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often. But I am not pleasant to be around when somebody has been sloppy. To this day, if one of our reporters gives me some information about one of our guests, and I say this is Billy Bob Boom Boom, who is a left-wing lobbyist for whatever, and I introduce him that way, and then he says, actually, I'm a right-wing lobbyist for whatever. Boy, when that, and I say, well, I'm sorry, and I go on my interview. But when I come out of that studio, I'm one of the things I've said to our people, and I say it every time it's necessary, every word that comes from our mouths as prepared copy had better be right. We have no control over what the guests are going to say, but we do have control over our own thing. And there, I just go crazy when somebody, usually somebody new on the staff, and I'll say, well, now, what is the, is it the Brookings Institute or is it the Brookings Institution? And they say, oh, it's one or the other. No, it isn't, friend. It's only one. And then, get a name wrong. It's just those kinds of things. And that's the kind of thing, if you don't learn that early, see, that's why I've always believed, well, I sound like an old fogey here, but I am an old fogey, so I can sound like that if I want to. It's it's why print experience is so good. And if you're in the real world of print, and you're sloppy, somebody's going to come down on you, and you're going to learn the hard way that the middle initial of some guy who died in South Dallas is just as important as getting a quote right from the President of the United States. And if you don't understand that, then you ought to go in another line of work. And the people who edit these damn newspapers and magazines and produce television programs ought to enforce that on people. They're the people who've got to teach that to the journalists of this world. And if you get it right, it's what it's all about. And
is it one strike and you're out?
Oh no! I'm not that fanatic about it. But their sloppiness is people look. But the reason you have to work so hard to get it right, because no matter how hard you work, you're still not going to get it right all the time. Because
yeah.
We're not in the history business. You're still, you're going to have to go with an incomplete story here and there. Things are going to fall through the cracks, and that's going to happen. But never because of sloppiness. And sloppiness you see in people and you can get rid of them. It's not just one thing that goes wrong. You fire somebody. I don't mean that.
You know, I was once engineering a show at the first station that I worked at. It was the evening news show, and I was engineering it, and I made some stupid mistake. I think I, accidentally turned somebody's mic off or played a record when it was supposed to be a clip of somebody giving an interview. I did something dumb. And the host of the show, when he got back on mic, said, I want to explain to the audience, I am not the engineer. I am not responsible for that error. I thought that was so cheap. But don't you sometimes have the urge to say that when someone's given you the wrong information and you've made a fool of yourself on TV?
Yeah. And exactly right. And in fact, that's what I say to them. I've said this many, many times. Somebody, I'm coming out steaming, and they say, oh, I'm really sorry. Those kind of things are going to happen and all of that. And I'm really, And then I say, yeah, and I am the person who had egg on his face and made a fool of himself on national television, and I don't like to do that. And you're exactly right. Oh, sure, I've been tempted to do that.
Now, here's the thing. You've had a heart attack, and you probably shouldn't get yourself really worked up, really aggravated about something, but it's so upsetting when you make an error on the air. So how do you handle that now?
Well, the best thing about my job is that it is daily. And when I do something dumb, what I try to do, I have a 15-minute drive from our offices, our studio, to my house in Washington. It takes 15 minutes, and I beat up on myself for 15 minutes. And then when I get into the house, I vow that I will not think about it anymore. And the great thing about it is I have to start thinking in the office the next day about what we're going to do that night. So the situation, I feel so sorry for people who do weekly or monthly programs who have a whole week to worry about the stupid things they did. And because the dailiness thing helps, and I've kind of gotten where I can mostly get it out of my head. But if they're really grievous, they stick around for a little longer.
In your early days as a journalist, you interviewed Elvis Presley and Steve Lawrence. What was Steve Lawrence really like? Just kidding.
Thank you, Terry.
If listeners could look at you and say, I think I know who he's voting for in the election, would that bother you?
Oh, it sure would. Ooh, I would feel like I am not doing my job.
Because you think your job is?
Well, my job is to sit there and help the viewers pick through it all. And if they thought I was helping them pick through it with some end result in mind, if I was them, I wouldn't watch me. I would watch me with a different eye, a different ear, and I hope that they would never do that.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's always a pleasure. Good luck to you.
One last question. What are you going to be doing election night?
Well, we're still talking about it. We're definitely going to be on the air. How long and when we're going to come on and all of that is still a matter of discussion, but we're going to probably do some stuff that probably television has not done before.
What's your dream show election night? When you watch other stations, what do you wish you were doing? If you had any amount of money and you could really draw it up?
Well, I would. It's a very simple dream. It would be to have the resources that the commercial networks have, which is to have all the polling data come in immediately, have access to all of the candidates and all of their headquarters and all of that, and then do McNeil Lair the rest of the time. Have people on who have something to say, people who have can tell us why certain things happen in the election. It would be a simple dream.
Okay.
It'd be a long dream, but a simple dream.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you, Terry.
And I wish you very good health.
Thank you.
Jim Lehrer's new memoir is A Bus of My Own. He co-anchors the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour on public television. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, we'll have a report on how the monetary crisis in Europe will affect the future of the Maastricht Treaty. That's the Treaty on European Economic Unity. There's a key vote in France coming up on that treaty this weekend. And NPR's Andy Bowers will have a report on the fact that independent counsel Lawrence Walsh is ending his almost six-year-long criminal investigation into the Iran-Contra affair. And we'll have a report from NPR's Patricia Flynn on Cuba. Communist leaders there say they'll be able to survive the loss of aid and close relations with their longtime sponsor, the former Soviet Union.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. People have always thought Woody Allen's movies were a bit autobiographical, but his new one, Husbands and Wives, is something else again. Should you see it because of what he's doing on screen, or should you see it because of what it tells you about his life off screen, or should you see it at all? Film critic Stephen Schiff is back, and he has some answers.
So how do we respond when we see Mia Farrow playing the mousy, miserable wife of Woody Allen, and she asks him desperately, "Do you ever hide things from me?" Does the audience rise up en masse and yell, "You betcha, baby!" Or do you try to convince yourself it's only a movie, only a movie? Watching Husbands and Wives is a queasy, embarrassing experience. You feel as though someone just caught you all beady-eyed in the checkout line, drooling over the tabloids. Yes, everything you've heard is true. Woody and Mia play a couple very like the couple they must have been over the last few years, loveless and droopy and sexually moribund. Besides which, Woody portrays a brilliant writing professor who begins a flirtation with a 20-year-old student, a tricky young man-eater named Rain, played with lots of mannerism and flash by Juliette Lewis.
How'd you get the name Rain?
My parents named me after Rilke.
Did they?
Yeah, it's my mother's favorite poet, and so that's how I got it.
Are you folks, writers, or...?
Oh, no, my dad's an investment banker and my mom works at Lincoln Center.
Are you an only child?
Why are you asking all these questions?
Well, I'm just interested. I was so impressed by the story. I gave it to someone else to read, and she was also very, very impressed with it, so I...
Oh, really?
Yeah, are you from New York, or...?
Yeah, I'm from East End Avenue. No, it's fine. It's just the only child one. Yes, I was the only child, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how did you manage to write something so deep? I mean, have you been married and divorced, or is your whole family stormy and tempestuous, or?
That scene has what a lot of a movie has, a tense, intriguingly edgy quality that unfortunately doesn't resolve or transport us anywhere. The movie takes the form of a fake documentary, with nauseously lurching camera work interrupted by little scenes in which the characters get interviewed. The whole conceit fails, partly because you can't imagine what documentary team would be interested in these dreary people and their familiar heartaches. Alan tries another trick he's tried before, too. He counterbalances his serious couple with a comical one. In the past, he himself has played the comical part, which almost invariably works, but here he makes the terrible mistake of casting himself and Mia in the serious roles, and you can't imagine a more morose pair. Fortunately, the comical couple are played by director Sidney Pollack and the great Judy Davis, and they nearly save the movie. Pollack plays a likable, slightly schlubby guy who's interested in a hot young aerobics instructor. As his wife, Davis is a tightly wound chain smoker with tough little opinions about everything. They seem ill-suited for each other from the first, but the minute they break up, very maturely and amicably, they begin to suffer the tortures of the damned. As for his own performance, well, Alan has never been so inert on screen. He's almost invisible, and his lines feel feigned and lifeless. The story is about the futility of relationships, about how love is always doomed and sexual attraction always dies, but even that sour message is dished up without conviction. Husbands and Wives is the work of a man who doesn't seem to feel or believe in much of anything anymore. And in that way, it's just as revealing as its audience is expected to be. Because if this movie is any evidence, all the lights have gone off in the soul of Woody Allen. And maybe it's not so surprising that he's turned to someone inexperienced and genuinely innocent to switch them on again.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurak directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a critique of the pundits who dominate our political dialogue. We talk with Eric Alterman, author of the new book Sound and Fury, The Washington Punditocracy and the Collapse of American Politics. I'm Jerry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.